You can now download a free PDF copy or purchase a beautiful printed edition of Issue 5 of the New Thinking Aloud magazine. New Thinking Aloud is a nonprofit endeavor. Your contributions to the New Thinking Aloud Foundation make a meaningful difference in our ability to produce new videos.
Thinking Aloud. Conversations on the leading edge of knowledge and discovery with psychologist Jeffrey Mishlove.
Hi, I'm Leanne Whitney, guest host, working alongside host Jeffrey Mishlove, co-host Emmy Vadnais, and my other colleagues here at New Thinking Aloud. Today, I'm excited to welcome Chris Niebauer to the show. Chris earned his PhD in cognitive neuropsychology from the University of Toledo, specializing in the differences between the left and right side of the human brain. He is the author of the best-selling book, No Self, No Problem, How Neuropsychology is Catching Up to Buddhism, and the workbook that followed. He was a professor at a state university in Pennsylvania for 22 years, where he taught courses on consciousness, mindfulness, left and right brain differences, and artificial intelligence. Today, Chris is joining me remotely from his home in Pennsylvania. So now I will switch over to the internet interview. Hi, Chris. Welcome to New Thinking Aloud. Nice to be with you today.
Oh, it's great to be here.
I love your book, No Self, No Problem, and I wanted to have a chat with you around consciousness and your specialty around the right and left hemispheres of the brain. I know consciousness is a really big topic, but I wanted to start really broad and then come down into the specialties and see what the aspects, the different hemispheres of the brain, what they specialize in, why it's important to be aware of that, how we can empower ourselves through that awareness. And I know you've studied Eastern thought, so feel free to fold in whatever feels important to you around your definition of consciousness and your experience of it also in the academy and while you are doing your degree and even now moving forward.
I probably avoid defining it as often as I can. And one of the things I've done over the years, particularly over the last year, is work on making a clear distinction between what the process of thinking is, what the process of cognition is, and the process of consciousness. And I think if you really look in the literature, it's one of the biggest confusions in the consciousness research going these days. And so you've got these wonderful books, and your audience is probably familiar with classics like Daniel Dennett and Consciousness Explained. And this is just, it's a wonderful book on thinking, but it doesn't talk about consciousness at all. And so I've spent quite a bit of time helping people to recognize that you can have consciousness without thinking. And that's a beautiful place that we get to through meditation. But you can't have thinking without consciousness. Thinking is just one particular manifestation of consciousness. And to me, it's not a very, the way I put it is, it's not a very high vibrational form of consciousness. It's almost like there's an inverse relationship. The more you turn down thinking, the more depth of consciousness you experience. And so we get up in the morning and we do these very simple things, just having your tea in the morning, having your coffee. And these are the rich conscious experiences that I believe are very difficult to define linguistically, because thinking is so much smaller than consciousness that we have a very difficult time fitting it into words.
Yes, because thinking sort of binds, right? It conceptualizes and it contracts and it tries to contain consciousness, whereas consciousness would be bigger than any container you try to put it in.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So, and you're talking about embodied knowing. So intelligence, knowledge, are they associated to consciousness for you, or?
They're useful tools, and what we've come to see as thinking, problem solving, I think if we take kind of an evolutionary viewpoint on these processes, they've recently been evolved. And so we haven't been thinking creatures our whole time. So if you look at our species, Homo sapiens, I mean, people speculate we've been on the planet about 300,000 years. Thinking probably only became dominant. And I'm just doing guesswork here, but it's very new. It may have popped up 50,000 years ago, and then it slowly became more popular. Then you can really see in the last 200 years. And so it's kind of like this. And then the last 200 years, it just really shot up to where we started defining our existence by the thinking process rather than the consciousness. And you got the classic Descartes, I think, therefore I am, which summarizes the Western position that it's thought that defines who I am. When one other option is to go back to our origins before we started thinking so much and redefine what human existence is actually about. And it all comes down to taking that sip of coffee, feeling the sun on your face, these simple, they're simple in ways, but of course the thinking mind has no way to figure it out. That's, you know, the whole hard problem of consciousness. It's just like you said before, it's because we're trying to put something vast and unexplainable into some linguistic thinking terms that are far too limited to capture something that is so unlimited and mysterious. And it's such a source of just absolute joy. And so that, you know, you wonder, why is meditation and mindfulness, they've exploded on the scene. I mean, they were around in the 70s, 60s, but now, you know, I live in this small town and we have this yoga on Main Street. We don't, they're popping up like everywhere. Why? Because we've pushed thinking to its absolute limits. We wake up in the morning, we have intrusive thoughts. We know now from research that intrusive thoughts can cause depression and anxiety. And we're desperately looking for that peace where thinking, we don't want to shut it off because thinking is very useful, but we probably only need to think an hour a day. And the rest of the day can be spent in this beautiful, problemless, conscious state of just perfect mindfulness. And so instead of using mindfulness as a practice, it just becomes a way of life.
But it's beautiful, you know, your coffee and that feeling, the sensation of the sun. So it's more, we are way more than just thinking creatures. We're feeling creatures. We're intuitive creatures. We have sensation. And we're, could we say we're looking for integration? We're looking to put it all together at this point. If thinking has gone too far, or we've overutilized it, then master perhaps is to cultivate feeling more. I think feeling wasn't even part of the academy, didn't even investigate feelings until like the 90s or maybe the early aughts or something, right? So it's come up, it's only coming along now.
And there's a giant irony with that because beings on this planet, so this comes from Antonio Damasio, the neuroscientist, and in his work, he suggests that feelings are 6, maybe 10 million years old. And so we were capable of conscious experiences like feelings, but they predate thinking to such a degree that, you know, in a culture that puts thinking first, we downgrade feelings and we don't trust them. But there's a reason for that. It's because when thinking is dominant, it interferes with the process of feelings. It directs feelings in ways that they weren't meant to go. And so when we can learn to turn down that thinking process, for me, this was a very profound experience. When I started experiencing feelings without thinking, I had realized their wisdom and their intelligence. and how they were directing my life. But that all becomes very problematic when thinking tries to hijack our feelings and take us to strange places, because the thinking mind simply doesn't have the wisdom.
Right. And as a culture in general, I think what you're saying, our culture in general that has been its path, really, towards this, I think, therefore I am, you know, that's the main pathway. And also, I don't know if you're familiar with attachment theory, but also that thinking function can also be a real survival tool as children develop, and if their needs aren't met, and this the development of the individual inside the collective, and I think that's part of what we'll get to. The thinking function can become this again, this bounded self. I don't need anybody. I don't want to feel, because I'm disappointed or I'm sad because there isn't connectivity in my environment. And in America, I don't know if you know the book, Constructing America, Constructing the Self by Phil Cushman, this idea of rugged individualism is kind of what we're built on. And I think, you know, your body of work, why I really enjoy it, is because you're showing, well, wait a minute, that individualism isn't even there. So we want to take a second look of what it means to be a person, but in a collective sense.
Well, when we think, one of the primary functions is, again, to solve problems. And so behind all that is this notion of causality. And causality has been handed to us through this framework from people like Newton in a very simple way, like A causes B. And so we get into this world model of seeing isolated events and how one variable can influence another. But when you get into the reality game and really get, and you step back. So actually, let me go back just a second here and describe one of the main differences between the left and right sides of the brain, because it really plays a huge role in this. And Ian McGilchrist has done a lot of great work on this, and he's popularized it. And the whole left-right brain thing probably would have went away if it were not for two people, Ian McGilchrist and Joe Bolte Taylor. They're two people on the planet that brought the left-right brain back into popularity and back in a way that is really needed right now. Because up until then, it was almost dismissed as pop psychology, and it was really hard to even get something published because people were just avoiding it. Anyway, the left brain's attentional system is incredibly narrow. It really wants to focus on one thing at a time. And that's why it's so involved in the process of thinking, because thinking is one thought at a time. I even did a challenge on my YouTube channel. Can you think two thoughts at once? And people had a very difficult time with it, because the process of thinking is one thought. And because it's so tied in with language, and we can only speak one word at a time, so the whole thing fits together very nicely. The right hemisphere is a whole different attentional system. It's vast. It can take the whole into consideration. It's watching it all happen at once. And that's why the right brain has so much more involvement when it comes to something like music. So when you compare music and language, language is one word at a time, but music is a complex integration, a symphony of all these happenings all at once. And then when you try to apply these two world models to reality, it turns out the left brain's world model is very limited, because it will catch things here and there that are causal, one thing causing another. But it doesn't have the ability to embrace 1,000 variables interacting in very complex ways. And so the more we can shift and into right brain modes of processing, the easier it is to gain access to what we might actually call actual reality, rather than our map of it that the left brain is making. So if you look at it, the left brain's map of reality is cartoon-like, very, very simple. the right brain is more like a 3D piece of art, and it's all interconnected. And so the more we can do this shift, particularly as a culture, from the left to the right brain, one, the more we get a picture of real reality. But then we also get to experience reality without breaking it down into parts. And so one of my favorite meditations, and a lot of meditations focus on one thing at a time, but I love the meditation where you actually spread your awareness as broad and general as possible. And so maybe you're outside and you're listening to one bird, you know, do its song, and then you have consciousness in two and three, and then it gets more and more. It's like consciousness expanding to a greater and greater degree. And when you get to those moments, you get really close to what we might call mystical experience, because you're starting to experience how things are not isolated. Things are not separate. It's a whole going on, and you're not separate from any of it. You're part of it. And so that's one of the things that I think the consequence of left brain thinking has been to isolate us. Like nature's out there. We're an observer. But the right brain, because its attention captures the whole scene, it recognizes that we are just as much a part of nature. It's not like you're outside meditating and there's a tree and the tree's natural, but you're some artificial, strange alien. It's like you're just as much part of the scene as the tree or the clouds.
Yes. I've heard it said before, the right hemisphere is the context, the left hemisphere, the text. So you have to have the text in its context. And we want to open up to a bigger and bigger context that we are part of. I mean, today with what's going on in the environment, I mean, that idea of our oneness, the interconnectedness, the integration. Yeah. And would you say, or through you, that expansiveness then is the past and the future are here in the present. And so when we're looking at multi-sensory perception and that, again, the context is just much larger. You're in this non-dual, could we say, non-local, where it doesn't matter how the distance, that we can still tap into the oneness or the wholeness. Is that what you feel the right hemisphere points to?
Yeah, and I like the way you put it. I think that's very accurate. It points to it. It's not necessarily it. It's more, the right hemisphere seems to act more like a bridge between us and something far more mysterious. And again, that mysteriousness is because when I say it's mysterious, it's mysterious to the left brain. So even in these experiences, the left brain is still doing its thing. And people have this, I mean, it's often described, particularly when people start to meditate and they start doing mindfulness, they have these brief moments of connecting and feeling part of everything. And when that door is open, I think a lot of things that make us feel that reveal our connection, things that fit under what we call parapsychology, that when the left brain, but it's still active, the left brain's still doing its thing. And when it comes back online, it looks at those experiences. And that's why, I mean, there's a strange paradox, because really thinking is an altered form of consciousness. But what we think is the mystical experience, that's our normal state. That's actually far closer to our origins. And it's far closer to the way other animals on this planet experience consciousness. There's no other animal on the planet that thinks as much as we do. And there are even cultural differences. And so we see this, and I always love talking about the Pitahan, a very small, all close to extinct culture in South America, where they virtually do not think at all. They are very particular about thinking, and they don't want to get pulled into it. So Westerners will sometimes, when they first start talking, it's very difficult because the language differences are very, very difficult to get over. But once you do, Westerners see our way of life as something that should tempt the Pitahan. Like, wouldn't you be tempted? Look at all the stuff we have. And it doesn't work. And in a beautiful line, and just to suggest to your listeners, it's Don't Sleep, There Are Snakes. It's a wonderful book that describes this culture, because something amazing happens when you turn thinking down, because they maybe think an hour a day. And they have some hardships that most Westerners couldn't even imagine. And so they've got malaria. The death is just commonplace. No health interventions. But in spite of all that, when Westerners first speak to them, the overwhelming impression is that they are the happiest people on the planet, in terms of laughter, in terms of joy. And the way Daniel Evert, he actually went in to convert them to Christianity. And the first thing he had to do was translate the Bible into their language. So first it was all this linguistic stuff that he was dealing with. But he had noticed that the quality that separated them from the West is they lived in the immediacy of experience. And so when we do meditation and mindfulness, we have to work at getting into the now. It's a practice. We have an undoing of what our culture has imposed on us, which is it has pushed us into these abstract worlds of the future and the past, and it has convinced us that the past and future, while they are illusions, they're more valuable than the immediacy of experience in the present moment. But that's something you could see as a huge shift, that people are recognizing that you can't be happy in the future. So, and there's no tomorrow never comes. And we know the past is, filled with illusions of memory. Memory is such a poor representation of what really happened. And so we're slowly, as a culture, reevaluating our values and getting back to, is success so important, or is being in the now more important? And when you see groups like this that are so convincing, and they have so little. When I say that, I'm talking from a Western point of view. They have so little in terms of the technological advancements invented by the left brain that, in principle, make life easier. But what they do is they get us into all the qualities of left brain thinking, which again takes us away from the only thing that's real, this moment. And it takes us into this fictitious futures, which never happen the way we think they are.
Right. Yet we have this left hemisphere. So the integration between the hemispheres is what we're aiming for. So, tell me a little bit more about that. Like, how is the left brain and its functions, and maybe you could go through that, the logic, the linear, the language, like, what does it really specialize in? You've listed a bit also of what the right, but maybe let's go there and talk really about what they each specialize in. And then this bilateral integration, because integration is the wholeness, right? So it's not I know you're not trying to sort of demonize the left hemisphere, right? So let's talk about its functionality and how it can serve us in integration.
Yeah, it's a great point. And to be fair, it can come off quite often that I do sound like I'm demonizing the left brain. and this is one of these things, again, the ultimate goal is exactly as you put it, integration and balance, because we are very imbalanced right now. So by pointing all these out, it's to start to recognize the path that we could go on to balance. And ironically, the path to balance is actually in recognizing some of the beautiful processing capacities, these things that are just how they just happen to us, and they happen in the left brain. And again, when we do problem solving, and so I often talk about, because we go for walks with our dog all the time, and our poor dog doesn't have this left brain problem solver. That's why he's mostly happier than us. but what he misses out on, so he gets his leash, he gets a caught around mailboxes all the time, and he can't figure it out. But you could take a 5-year-old kid, and their left brain is so good at problem solving. They know, you know, our dog just keeps pushing forward. But if you just back up, then you can untie yourself and you're free. So there's these wonderful problems that come up once in a while. And the left brain is just so good at what it does. When you get the left brain doing what it does well, like right now, we couldn't have this conversation. And so language happens, these inventions that we've continuously improved on. And so, you know, indoor plumbing and these things that, you know, the left brain just seemed to be tweaking things over and over again until it came up with what we might call modern civilization. And so you can really appreciate when the left brain's doing what it does well. The only place that we run into a problem is that we've turned over the big questions, like the meaning of life. We've turned over questions about how do I feel connected to my culture, to other people. We've turned those over to the left brain because we've become so convinced that everything is a problem to solve. And so when there's this imbalance, the left brain starts looking at everything as a problem because that's what it's good at. And suddenly life is a problem. And we think, well, we have to solve the problem of life, but it's just an experience to be had. There's no problem. And it's not a fault of the left brain. It's just doing its job. And that's another really important thing. So it's out there to try to find patterns so we can make predictions and increase our survival value. I actually look at the left brain as, again, a survival tool, and it's never been updated. And so it's 50,000 years without an update. And so it's still trying to solve these problems of survival that happened to us as a species 50,000 years ago. And so it's extremely good at what it does, but we'll never find our way to returning to our essence until we find that balance. And by integrating the left brain, that means letting it do what it's good at. Like I would never, work on my computer to fix a flat tire. I mean, that would be weird. You know? And in some ways, we're trying to use the thinking tool to bring meaning to our lives. And then we can't figure out why it's not working.
I love where you're going with that. When like you can't solve for life, you're in it. And if meaning is inherent in life, it's life. It's life. It's this living experiential essence or beingness. You can't solve for it because it's the thing that you're in. So yeah, I love where you're going with that. And it does. It creates a tremendous amount of suffering by trying to overuse the left hemisphere. And you know, it's like right-handed or left-handed. If you overuse muscles too much, you become imbalanced in the physical body. And that's the same that we're seeing. You know, if a culture becomes very left hemispheric, then the culture in and of itself becomes imbalanced, that it becomes about the identities. And, you know, the left loves narrative, it loves stories, but when we're bound into a story and we don't see the story for what it is, a map or a guide, So maybe you could take us, you know, into that suffering a little bit more deeply, and why does the left hemisphere tend to bind so hard around its stories or identifications? Is it survival of itself, or what is that interplay back and forth between the right and left hemisphere when it comes to survival?
Well, one, just creating a story of the self gives you something to survive.
Right.
We've got this, maybe you would call it an error of perception, where we look inward and we see this pattern that doesn't even exist. But you put that along with a problem-solving device whose identity depends on solving problems. And I'm not sure if you've, I really need to remember the technical name of this paper. People just call it the the blue dot experiment. I don't know if you're familiar with it, but it's a wonderful experiment that shows what the left brain is all about. And so the experiment was pretty simple in the sense that all the subjects had to do was hit a button when the blue dot appeared. And on the screen, there are blue dots, but there were also purple and all these other colors. Now, eventually, they just took all the blue dots out of the picture. Now, you'd think you'd just stop responding, but that's not what people did. They redefined what the problem was. And so now they started looking for purple dots, and they'd respond to them. And it's so interesting, and I wish I could remember the author's names. I need to give them credit because it's such a really interesting experiment because they did it in so many different ways. They would look at angry faces. So the first part, hit a button when you see an angry face. Then don't show any more angry faces. Well, instead of stop responding, they actually just changed their definition. Well, their left brain just changed their definition of what an angry face is. And they did this in so many ways, and it didn't even really matter if you told the subject about it. And what that shows is something that the Buddha stumbled on 2,500 years ago in the nature of desire and how unending it is, and how once we reach one state, the left brain, in order to feel alive and feel significant in terms of its existence, redefined what the problem is, which keeps us in an endless cycle of continuously trying to find a problem that could have been solved a long ago. And so, it's a really interesting way to take modern science and connect it with something the Buddha figured out, the whole idea of desire and how that's the cause of all of our suffering. But that desire is a reflection of our always trying to find a problem. And when you, maybe one of the most significant experiences people can have is when they learn to turn down thinking, how many problems go along with that.
Right. Contentment, which the Buddha points towards. I'm a longtime yoga practitioner. Santosha, contentment, is a big part of that system of thought. And of course, both yoga and Buddhism being inside the Indian canon of thought, but they do have patterns and stories. So Jyotish, or the astrology of that system of thought, is quite important. Again, it's like all comprehensive and inclusive, Ayurveda. And then the Bhagavad Gita is also one of the core texts, which is a story. It's a mythological story about right living, right action, right alignment. So yeah, maybe sort of if you could tell us like how you perceive that and how that system of thought folded in all those things in their vision of wholeness.
To me, the most important of the part of the Tao Te Ching is the very beginning, because it points out this paradox so beautifully. The Tao that can be named is not the Tao. And so, but I'm going to go on and finish writing this. And you find that in so many spiritual teachings. And I think, I was watching Rupert Spira just recently, and he just came out and he's like, everything I say is a lie, which is absolutely, these are just pointers. That's the purpose of stories, and I think that the original purpose of stories was to help problem solving. And it was like, that's what there's a few, again, I'm not very good with names, but two big famous psychologists were talking about object recognition. And they were saying that even recognizing a simple object comes down to telling a story. And so the brain is creating some little map of what might be out there, which is extremely useful. And so we've seen this with people who lose the ability for object recognition, their lives become very, very difficult. And it's something that we just take for granted. So we look out and we see a computer screen, and, you know, I'm surrounded here with guitars. And so I could name them all, you know, and so it's an extremely useful thing. It's just, to me, it's a world that is nice to visit, but I think to integrate it would be to have the relation to be reflecting the nature of our actual true existence, which is to say, we're conscious beings first. It's in consciousness that we find joy. It's in consciousness that there are no problems. And the thinking mind is an incredibly useful tool. It's just, it's not a very good master. The thinking mind is not the GPS system that we should be using for our life. But it's, you know, an awesome tool. And just to go on about a few more qualities of the left brain. One of the things the left brain does, and it may be one of the main things the left brain does, and it's a remarkable talent. I mean, neuroscience has no clue how it does this, but it does this process called categorization. And categorization is where we, and again, it does this because it can focus its attention on only one thing. And so when we categorize, we limit our attention to one quality that many things have in common, and then we create a group. And that is so useful. It would be virtually impossible. So my son is in soccer, and he's been playing forever. And so when you think about it, categorization makes a soccer game really easy to watch, because you've got, you know, half the people out there have green shirts, other half blue. And just by being able to categorize everyone with the blue shirt as being on one team, that's very useful. And it can actually be really fun. And so this idea of categorization is something that we've used as a tool for a very long time. It's just a map of reality. Categorization has no underlying actual existence. These categories that we come up in our mind, they're not categories of reality. They're these tools that the left brain comes up with. So that's one of these wonderful things the left brain does in moderation. And to me, the important thing is when you create a category, which is to say your left brain does, to recognize it for what it is. It's just this useful tool.
Right. But we tend to take it so seriously. And I feel like is one of the main points you're saying. Use it, but use it wisely. So it's right view. It's like, it's being able to have the right view. And is that part of the integration process, is the mastery, the coming to awareness of this is what my left hemisphere is doing. This is what my right is doing. How do I work with the wholeness, the context, as well as the text, as well as the naming or the grouping? How can I work with it? But so I stay in that contentment, in that harmony, in that peace. And I think that's one of the key cornerstones of your book, is that's what it's teaching people, that, you know, differentiation. A lot of things that you say are very yoga oriented. I know it's Buddhism that you've mainly studied, but the second line of the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali is yoga's chittavritti nirodha. The restraint of the modifications of the mind stuff is yoga. So when thinking is when we involute, when we silence the mind and retrieve all our projections and sit in stillness, that's yoga. That shows us the wholeness, of which then the contentment can arise. So again, it's beautiful pointers, and in that idea of the differentiation is important, but also the linkage. So we're able to see the hemispheres, but then link them so we can have them, again, through mastery, so that we can have them both functioning and working at their top but balanced level, I think maybe we could say.
Absolutely. And again, we've become a very categorical culture. And the balance isn't using categoricals usefully, but not letting them dominate.
Right. So you can perceive on a more holistic, instead of, again, being bound into trying to force the self into something in particular that you have in mind, that you open up to the feelings and the sensations and allow more to come through. Is that where you're going with that?
Yeah. And when we are stuck in these categorical worlds of the left brain, again, they're very cartoon-like. They're very simplified. And when we build identities around that, it's extremely limiting to our true nature, because we're beyond any category. You know, if we're going to say, well, who are we? And then we answer that with some category. You know, whether it's age or any, you know, I'm successful, I'm rich, I'm poor. I mean, whatever category you choose to identify yourself, it's just, you know, very limited identification, and it could change any second. So one of the things I point out in the book is that, you know, the Buddha pointed out that the self isn't some stable entity, that what we consider to be the self, it could change in 30 seconds. It could, you know, you could be rich one moment, then in jail the next moment. And, you know, these things, it's always a pro. So none of that can be really who you are. And so all these categorical identities that we create, when you realize the categories are left brain fictions, you go deeper into the question of who am I, and recognize, like, well, what if I'm beyond any category? What if categories are fiction? Then I must be something beyond a category. And that gets you beyond thinking. And then the identity issue becomes a lot more interesting.
Yeah, I love that. Beautiful. Well, before we head to the close here, one last idea. Now, the left hemisphere, it doesn't actually develop until like 2 years old, or there's a developmental sequence to how the brain comes online. And it's mostly like the body into the right hemisphere, and then the left hemisphere develops a little bit later. So I mentioned sort of a little bit of a trauma-informed perspective earlier. Now, for children born into households where, let's just say, parents are under really bound identities, so there's a lot of sort of commandments or maybe even violence as that parent sort of protects their own sense of identity. What happens in that developmental process for a child who's born into an environment where that joy isn't, you know, that joyful play and that nurturing care isn't the initial environment? Is it? So that's part of the question. Like, is environment important to the development of the brain? And if so, is that perhaps part of what we're seeing, is some kind of intergenerational distress through this boundedness? And now, because depression and anxiety, you know, these are things that as mindfulness has grown very popular, also the rates of depression and anxiety and suicide have gone up. I'm wondering if there's, not that the trauma-informed way is necessarily your specialty, but do you have any insights to the way that the brain develops and that idea of me, not me, that soft identity that's fluid, it's in the flow of integration, it's neither too rigid nor chaotic, right? So I'm pointing to when children grow up in households where there is that rigidity, what happens for the brain development?
Well, I love that phrase you use, like soft identity. That's a really nice way to put it, because like all identities should be tentative. And when you, and that's really the way it is for the right brain. you know, their stories, you play them. They've invented a test for a self. And it's pretty straightforward. You look at a mirror, and if you recognize that that's a you, at least some aspect of you, then you're considered to have passed it. And so I had a lot of fun with my kids, putting them in front of mirrors when they were like one. Nothing, they never got it. Like, I've got this wonderful little clip of my son, and he's looking at this mirror, and then he keeps going behind it because he thinks it's some kid. And he's like mystified, like, okay, there you are. And then he looks and he's like, where'd you go? And he did this so long that I was able to get a camera and actually take a video of it, which, you know, that rarely happens. And then something clicks in about two. And this is when we see the whole identity process click in. And that's when the left brain interpreter, language, it all starts to happen all at once. And all of a sudden, then they start using me and mine. And all of a sudden, they have a concept of self. And that could be very much related to the fact that we start talking when we're two. And if ever read some of how Helen Keller described her existence, and she really said that she never had a self until she started talking. And, you know, until she was able to use language. And as soon as she was able to use language, and then all of a sudden there was a self-concept there. And one, it's interesting that humans are not the only animals that pass the self test. And so we've got, you know, the great apes pass it. And, you know, if you put something, say, on their forehead and they're anesthetized, so they don't know it's there. And then you put them in a mirror, they'll touch that spot, suggesting they recognize that's me in the mirror. And, even some birds will do this, which is interesting because it doesn't show that the self is a necessarily contingent upon the complexity of the brain, but has something to do with some symbolic process that starts to take place in the left brain. And so the problem, so the self, well, so we spent this wonderful 2 years, you know, free of problems, living in reality, conscious all the time of moments in our life. We were born into this world perfect practitioners of mindfulness and meditation. I mean, that's what we did. And then the thinking program turns on it too, and that creates the sense of an identity. But the thing is, along with that starts coming all the me stories. And with all the me stories, that gives the opportunity for things like depression, anxiety. You really can't have, you know, if you ever watch when people use this phrase, they always say, I am depressed. I am anxious. And that reflects how much the anxiety, I've never heard a person to say, you know, there's anxiety floating around up here. You know, that's a big difference though. Those two statements are really different in what they're getting at. Because when you say I am anxious and I am depressed, that's really two stories. It's the self story, but then it's a story about the self. And if you just keep it simple and say, well, there's depression, there's anxiety floating around, that takes away half the baggage. But we create the self story about two. And then anything that happens, if we look at the evolutionary story, there's probably a reason why we had a self in terms of survival. That story of the self, even if it doesn't exist, probably helped us some way in survival. But the consequence of that, and evolutionary psychologists will always tell you, like, all the tricks of evolution helped us survive. They were not there for our happiness. And so we were always tuned in to things that might have endangered our survival. And of course, these were the negative things in our lives. And anything that was, you know, life-threatening, these were all the traumas. And so the brain is wired in a way that makes these memories very permanent. They're not like other memories that we easily forget. And it's not a curse. It's not there as a punishment. It's a simple survival tool. And so there's two different approaches. People say, well, can we turn the thinking mind down and all these bad memories and all these things that happen? Another way to do it is to become the observer of it. And to distance your identity with it and to see it as like if I have a bad memory, if I have a memory that I might label as depressing or anxious, rather than trying to control it, because we're terrible at controlling this thinking mind. And you could prove that to your audience. If I just say, don't think of the number 13, you know, you just and say, so if I say, don't think about your trauma, it's like, you know, don't think about this bad memory. It's just not going to work. But if there is, I think the initial trick is to distance your identity from it. And there's a wonderful identity to be found in simple conscious experiences rather than the stories generated by the left brain. And then you can become just an observer of them. And even if it is a depressing thought, it's not part of your identity. So instead of saying, I am depressed, you recognize that, well, there's just, you know, and the way they talk about in the East, everything comes and goes. And so just like a storm, it's going to come and then it's going to go. But when we try to solidify that with the idea of the self, that keeps it around. That energizes it. And it's very easy, as we've seen with culture, to particularly if you're encouraged to start focusing on the bad things that's happened in your life. The left brain loves it. And the left brain loves it because it would rather have a story that's sad and anxious than the recognition that the story is just a story and it doesn't have any actual existence in and of itself.
So work with the experience, I think is what you're saying. Become mindfully aware, soften the story, let go of the story, and work with the body directly. Work with the feelings of the anxiety or the depression, not with an identity, but through mindfulness or, again, conscious awareness. Yeah, beautiful. Well, thank you so much for bringing your wisdom and knowledge of the left and right hemispheres to the New Thinking Aloud community. It's been great to have you here and to, yeah, share all your research. And do you have any one last thought, anything about heading into the present moment of today? Or what would you say the greatest pearl of wisdom is?
That we've gotten ourselves into a thinking problem, and we're under the illusion that we can think our way out using more thinking. And so my pointer would be that we're not going to get out of a thinking problem with more thinking. So explore other modes of awareness. They're wonderful modes. They almost never have problems associated with them. And just the immense joy of consciously experiencing the body, being in a body, you know, being able to taste something, being able to, the light that you can experience from just visual experiences, watching a sunset, or it doesn't even have to be something as magnificent as a sunset. It could be a rock sitting on the sidewalk. And it just, it brings you into a mystery of the nature of our existence that is beyond anything that we can think about. And then to recognize that the mystery isn't out there. You are that mystery.
Beautiful, beautiful. Thank you so much, Chris, for being here today and for being with us. Really appreciate it.
Well, thank you. It was fun.
And for those of you listening or watching, thank you for being with us, because you are the reason why we're here, in community, exploring our common unity.
Book 2 in the New Thinking Aloud Dialogues book series is a tribute to parapsychologist Russell Targ celebrating his 90th birthday. New Thinking Aloud is a non-profit endeavor. Your contributions to the New Thinking Aloud Foundation make a meaningful difference in our ability to produce new videos.